This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and coming up in the second half of today's show, it's time for another Main Street Eats with root cellar Sue Balcom. But we are going to start with the Great American Folk Show. Episode 5 is coming up on Prairie Public on Sunday, September 6th at 5 o'clock Central. And joining me now is host and creator of the show, musician Tom Brousseau. Tom, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
I had a nice discussion with the producer of this show, our Eric Dethridge, and he and I both agreed, this one is really special.
Yeah, it is a special one. It's on a couple of different levels, I think it's a special one. What was it that the two of you discussed?
We really enjoyed that there is a new level of depth and connection with what's going on in the social justice world right now. I mean, I feel like your show has kind of increased in diversity on every episode, but in specific, you have a monologue from Old Crow Medicine Show member Willie Watson, and both of us, and I think it's fair to say you, were probably struck by this monologue where he talks about addressing racism within his own career. One of the previous band members got kicked out because of telling terrible jokes and saying that he would have killed Martin Luther King if he had the chance.
It's an interesting monologue, and it's a very respectful monologue. Willie Watson of Old Crow Medicine Show, although I don't know if he's, you know, still in the band, but he was a part of this very influential band in the late 90s, early 2000s, called the Old Crow Medicine Show. And as it is detailed in the monologue of Willie Watson, the band moves down south, primarily to soak up the roots of the music that they all loved and admired. And, you know, I think all of the members of that band are compulsive listeners. I think they listen to all kinds of, you know, genres of music, from country to gospel to rock and roll, but where their passion is, and you can tell this from Willie Watson's monologue, it's in the early roots, the country blues, and for that, really, the South is where to go. And so his monologue is about that experience. And, you know, when I approached Willie to be on the show, he took it very seriously, and yeah. I kept on having to check in with him. Willie, how are you doing? Can you send me the materials? We're getting close to the air date. And
deadline.
he was very concerned about this monologue. And I didn't really know what to expect. But knowing Willie like I do, I knew that it was going to be great. And it was going to be meaningful. And indeed, his 9-minute monologue, which doesn't seem like 9 minutes, really take you on that journey.
How surprised were you, or what was your reaction when you did finally get it? Because it's different from every monologue I've heard on the show.
Well, I was first struck by, as I always am with the guests that have been on the show, how much of an expert it seems each and every one are. Putting, you know, expressing themselves. And in Willie's case, it has an arc and there's some dimension in it. So from just a fan of literature and of nonfiction and of diary reading and writing, I was just really impressed by his abilities to, you know, to relay this diary entry. You know, it's one thing to experience it and do it, but it's a whole nother beast to sit down and write it out in a thoughtful way. And so Willie does that expertly. And so when I say that 9 minutes go by just like that, it's really true. I mean, it's you are taken in inside of this guy's diary. But I was also wasn't shocked. I was just, I suppose, I was impressed in a way that he was able to tell this story, that he was able to confront some of the things that he confronted on his journey in music. And I think that, you know, when we're learning about different musics and different cultures and different arts, we don't know what we're going to get into. And I think in Willie's case that was something that he didn't expect, despite the fact that, you know, yeah, I just don't think he really knew what to expect. And this is, you know, this particular diary entry of his monologue, which I would call a diary entry. This is something that happened, you know, in the late 1990s, and it's obviously very close and very personal. It's been that way for him ever since.
It reminded me, too, of an essay that we had on Main Street earlier this week from historian Dr. Tom Ezern, and he talked about this thing called song catching. Mm-hmm. Not exactly the same thing as songwriting, but musicians who would travel around, immerse themselves in a culture, and maybe pick up the songs of these people, mm-hmm. and then record them into hit records. And who knows if they ever even knew the original artists, or certainly ever gave them any credit for it. And Willie does this song-catching thing by taking a poem that he was inspired by.
You know, song catching is an art form, and I wonder how people get into it. I wonder if they eventually get into it because they're inspired by the biography of the song, or the people involved or the cultures involved, and then they just get that bug to where they kind of put their own personal songwriting aside to go out into the world to find the songs that are still in existence and to catch them before they die. And, you know, there's a lot of people who do this, a lot of music enthusiasts who do this, they song catch. And I liken it to some of these great photographers, they go out into the wilderness, they experience harsh conditions just to get that one shot, mm-hmm. to kind of catch that thing, whatever it is. And I think that's the same with song catching. You want to catch that thing. And it's doubtful anybody really knows who wrote any of these songs or why they wrote them, too. It's just, you know, it just seems like the questions that one has when one is entering into the world of songwriting, just more and questions unfold, you know. And maybe that's the lure of it.
Yeah.
But, you know, and I also, that's one thing that I love about Willie Watson and a lot of people that I know, is that they put aside their own songwriting to highlight some of the great songs that are just lost in the world, or some they put music to some of the great poems that, you know, a lot of people just don't even know about. And I just think that's a very noble thing.
Yeah, those undertold stories.
Mm-hmm.
You also have this wonderful friendship with a man named Tomo. Tell us about him.
Tomo Nakayama, great singer-songwriter, just a very, very dimensional, multi-dimensional artist from the Pacific Northwest, originally from Japan. And as I mentioned in the episode, I met Tomo when I first started going to Seattle, Washington, primarily because he's really cherished all over. But, you know, that's his hometown. And I find the Pacific Northwest really take care of their local artists, and Tomo is one of them. And, you know, his style is unique. He's got this really beautiful high voice. It's an emotional experience to hear him because of the expression that he has in his songwriting, but also, you know, his voice is just really kind of is very a touching thing. But, you know, when you become a fan of somebody, as I did with Tomo, then it becomes, it's not just that easy to become their friend. You know, it kind of takes time. And so I would say over the years, although I have deeply respected Tomo and really loved his work, we slowly became friends. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe, you know, we were really able to get on that level once we started to kind of tour and play shows outside mm-hmm. of the Pacific Northwest. But he's a pretty special guy, Tomo Nakayama.
And his monologue, too, is similar to Willie's in that it spans two different worlds. Like you mentioned, he was born in Japan and mm-hmm. moved to the Pacific Northwest. And then when he's visiting Japan, he meets this man who is basically, it ends up, this is who I would have been if I'd have stayed in Japan, basically.
It's a very interesting monologue of his journey in music and how, you know, he came to the United States and became a U.S. citizen, but then he had the opportunity to go back to Japan to play music. And really, you know, music, I find, is almost just an excuse to hang out with somebody or to have another experience. And it's so true. I mean, the places that I've gone because of music, I almost think, gosh, is music really even any part of it? Because you're on the stage for 45 minutes, and the rest of the day, the 23 hours left in the day, you know, you have nothing but time for journeys and, you know, adventures. And I think because of that, you're bound to have these experiences. But in Tomo's case, he goes back to Japan. He meets someone who is exactly the same person who he is. And he finds out that they even have the same connection to the same small village in the countryside of one of those countryside Japan towns. I mean, that is really remarkable. Mm-hmm. It's like, how could that have happened otherwise?
Yeah. You know, what fascinates me about this episode 5 and in talking to you is the parallels between Willie and Tomo's monologues and the fact that you did not give them, you didn't say, hey, I want something on bridging two worlds.
Right.
You just said you wanted to hear from them, and they both came up with these monologues or diary entries, as you'd call them, that while very different, are on kind of that same, they're working on that same gut level there. That must feel pretty good to hear that synchronicity show up in your life.
You know, I think that when you are dealing with professional musicians and people who have done it, I'll just say artists, you know, I think this is kind of what you get this thoughtful inspection of some of the footsteps that, you know, they've taken. And in Willie's case and in Tomo's case, they are both called to a particular region for some reason, for a love or for a passion or for, maybe they don't even really know why, despite the fact that Willie goes down to the South with his band to immerse in the culture and the music, to learn. Maybe there really isn't any reason that they know of why they are there. Maybe maybe it's just one of those invisible threads that is pulling them there, like it pulled Tomo back to Japan. You know, sometimes I think the gods don't like it if you try to figure out exactly why. You know what I'm saying?
No, they don't.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's part of what makes me a non-musician is that ability to just kind of go with whatever comes and play improv. And I am very much like anticipating what someone is going to say and you know, planning my next question. And of course, you know, being in radio long enough, you at some point have to get over that.
Right.
But I know that you are more used to this as a musician, that ability to just roll with it. But did anything change when you started working on this show and you just gave all control of your own show away immediately?
A lot did, but I've still kind of held you know, I think you one must know their craft. There's no doubt about it. You got to know it. But then the work, I think, then is not continuing to know your craft. It's letting go. And when you let go, I think really magical things can happen. Mm. And this is nothing that I would ever take credit for or could ever take credit for. It just is what happens when you know what you do, and then you got to let go of it. But I think, you know, one of the things that I'm starting to appreciate about this show, and primarily because of that particular ideology, is that there does still have to be a scope. It has to be grounded. Otherwise, it's just going to be wild all over the place. And so, I think we've been fortunate with the guests who have come on, but at the same time, there is a scope of what, you know, it is I'm hoping to find for the show. And certainly, you know, I'll have to keep that. I do keep that in mind when I have guests on.
Yeah. Well, it sounds a little to me like part of that scope, especially in this episode, but in all previous episodes too, is very much tied to that sense of place. And Willie mm-hmm. and Tomo's essays mm-hmm. both talk about that sense of place, but then you also are not forgetting your North Dakota roots. You have North Dakota Associate Poet Laureate Bonnie Larson Steiger, and then we hear more notes from the Badlands with a Theodore Roosevelt repriser.
Mm-hmm.
That sense of place. You always come mm-hmm. back to North Dakota.
I always do. You know, I always do, and I always will, and I can't wait to physically. One of these days, I am going to be back in a North Dakota town, be it Fargo or maybe Hatton, maybe Wimbledon. Maybe I'll move to Wimbledon.
Or you go see if the Drayton Dairy Queen is busy.
Sure, I'll open that back up again.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we all have that sense about us that. That's the sense of home, you know, and maybe for a certain portion of all of our lives, we go out into the world to seek new territory. But then I do think that we do start to come back to our home. And certainly, you know, that's been me for quite a while.
Yeah.
There's a great poem by Edward Dorn. Ed Dorn, he was a great poet, kind of post-beat poet or right around the beat era. And he has a poem about the cosmology of finding your place. Mm-hmm. And it's about and one of the images in the poem is this dog is going to his little, you know, dog bed, and he starts to sit down, and nope, that's not comfortable, so he has to turn around the other way. Starts to sit down. No, that's not comfortable, and he has to turn around the other way.
No.
We've all seen dogs do this, you know, about, you know, we're not quite ready to settle in just yet. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it's all the Wizard of Oz in the end.
Mm-hmm.
You had two guests who, because of timing, had to get cut from mm-hmm. this show. It's a good problem to have. Do you know what you'll be doing with Lisa Sanders and Jonas Cannon? Will you be keeping them for future episodes?
I think so. I'm going to... It's and if anything, it just shows you how inexperienced I am when it comes to putting these shows together. I want to present each episode with a slice of the important things that are happening, and you know I kind of failed in a way on this one that I thought I could fit it all in. But Jonas Cannon is a zine maker. And he'll be likely will be on the October broadcast, and I'm hoping that Lisa Sanders, a really great singer-songwriter, will also be on that broadcast.
Yeah, you have to be learning a little bit about being a producer on this case too. You're doing all the booking yourself.
I'm doing all the booking, and it's not easy, and it's not fun to have to go back to Lisa Sanders or Jonas Cannon and say, "I'm so sorry." But, you know, I think they understand, and it has nothing to do with, it's just a timing issue, and, you know, thank God people understand that, otherwise they could legitimately be mad at me. because they did advertise it. And, you know, I'm having to go back and say, oh, no, I can't. Aww. I'm so sorry. We're going to do it the next episode. But as you say, it's a good problem to have. This is a high class problem to have. kind of, I'm grateful in a way that people are responsive to being on the show, yeah. that they have taken it seriously, and that they've devoted time and energy to recording their segments. I really appreciate that.
Well, you could almost get some advice from one of your other guests, David Garza. I mean, I've heard of a one-man band, but this guy, I mean, he's playing his own instruments and singing his own songs, but he's making his own band posters. He's booking his own tours. He's just like insane. He does all the things.
He does everything. And he's established himself where he doesn't really need anyone else. He probably could if he wanted to. And maybe he has some friends that help him. And, you know, for me to have David Garza on the show was really kind of a high honor, because when I was really wanting to do music, Ashley, when I was living in Grand Forks and watching MTV and VH1 and trying to get some of the moves that some of these people had in their videos and fashion, David Garza came on during one of the commercial breaks, and he was featured in a Best Buy commercial. And, you know, when I saw him, it took my breath away seeing this guy, his style, and the way that he sang, and how energetic he was and charismatic he was just in that 30-second video that he was in a Best Buy commercial. That really and honestly prompted me to want to go out there and do music, and that I would eventually meet him. Wow. And, you know, become a friend of his, and he became a friend of mine is really great. So I really appreciate having him on. And he represents this whole other role model for musicians, and that, you know, if you believe in yourself, then, you know, you can do it. If you believe in yourself, as opposed to you got to get a booking agent, you got to get a manager, you got to do this, you got to do that. You know, you don't necessarily need to get all of those ducks in a row, because, you know, that's a whole nother ball game. You can just go out there and do it like David Garza.
And
that's a very hopeful thing.
Yeah. Tom Brosseau is a musician and the host of The Great American Folk Show. Episode 5 plays right here on Prairie Public at 5 o'clock Central, 4 o'clock Mountain. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you so much for having me on Main Street.
Still to come on Main Street, we hear from a doctor who is active in both the HIV/AIDS crisis and has done a lot of work in cancer about his response to this pandemic. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The fundraising arms of North Dakota State University, the University of North Dakota, Valley City State University, and Minot State University are notifying alumni and friends of a security incident involving a third-party vendor that may have involved some personal information. A ransomware hack targeted Blackbaud, a company that handles financial management and administration software around the world. The cyber criminals removed backup files from the system, and the company paid a ransom demand and assured the files taken from its system were destroyed. NDSU Foundation spokesperson Nicole Tom Ahrens stressed those notified do not need to take any action, and no financial information was involved in the data breach, as the foundation does not store any bank, debit, or credit card information.
The email went out to individuals in our database who are outside North Dakota and Washington State, and that was about 54,000, a little under 54,000.
Blackbaud said it has implemented changes after the attack. Those responsible have not yet been identified. A program to plug and reclaim abandoned oil wells is putting a lot of people to work in the oil patch. North Dakota Mineral Resources Director Lynn Helm says when he first proposed using federal CARES Act money to do the project, he had expected to employ about 1,000 oil workers. Helms told the state's Industrial Commission 700 people have already been working on the plugging end of it.
We will kick off the 7 reclamation contracts early next week, might get out there late this week, and that's going to be 1,000 people. So we'll be at 1,700 by this time next week. And as we roll out the next batch, we're going to go from 14 workover rigs plugging to 20 next week. So we'll be at approximately 2,000 full-time employees.
And the director of the North Dakota Census Office says the census will essentially conclude by the end of September. Kevin Iverson says that includes self-reporting as well as door-to-door contacts. Iverson says about 64% of the state has self-responded, and he says that's slightly below the national average. But he says the state is a little ahead on non-response follow-up, where census workers go door-to-door.
An additional 22% of the state's households had been followed up on. So statewide, we're at about 86% of households have now been responded. And I'm pretty comfortable in the next 4 weeks that we'll be pretty close to, or if not completely, counted for all households in the state.
Iverson is encouraging people who haven't yet been contacted to go online to census.gov and fill out the form. Iverson says what's at stake is the state's share of federal dollars, which is based on population. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. From the Conversations on Healthcare podcast, hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter speak with Dr. William Hazeltine, president of Access Health International, a global health think tank. He is also a renowned scientist, entrepreneur, philanthropist, and founder of Harvard Medical School's HIV/AIDS and Cancer Research Centers. In this excerpt, he shares some thoughts about the nation's response to the COVID-19 pandemic.
Dr. Hazeltine, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You chaired the Global Health Summit in Wuhan, China, in October of last year, sort of gathering some of the leading scientists in the world. I assume little did you know what was to come just a few months later, as Wuhan became the epicenter of the outbreak for COVID-19. But I'm wondering, as someone who is part of this larger global scientific community seeking to prevent such catastrophes like COVID-19, how could we have addressed the response more effectively?
I'm the chair of the U.S.-China Healthcare Summit. That is an organization that was created as China reached out to the United States to help it address its issues with SARS. And in particular, it drew upon the expertise at Harvard School of Public Health and many of my former colleagues there. And from that, they would send their health experts from all over the country for a education and learning session. And many of the people who are managing the COVID epidemic in China were trained at Harvard specifically for that. They even went so far as to give courses to the Central Party School. So there's been a very close relationship. The other thing I would say about Wuhan, and when I think about Wuhan, I'm really sad. Wuhan's a lovely city.
Yeah.
It's a garden city. It's a big city. The three rivers have come together. It's in the center of China at the Yangtze River. It's got mountains. It's got forests. It's just a beautiful city. That's where the Sun Yat-sen Revolution began. It's where all LEDs come from, and they know it, because at night the whole place is lit up. And it's just sad for me because the head of my foundation is from Wuhan. He lost three grandparents in 3 weeks in January and couldn't go to their funerals. I was in touch on a daily basis with what was going on in Wuhan in the early days. And so let's transit from that to what's gone wrong in the United States. Things don't have to go wrong. There's nothing inevitable about what's happened in the United States. China had a big epidemic first in Wuhan. About 80,000 people got infected in Wuhan. About 4,000 people died. The numbers outside of Wuhan and Hubei province are virtually negligible. Maybe they're numbered no more than 100, 200 people infected. That says something right away. They contained it to Wuhan. Now, when I think of the history, everybody hears, oh, the Chinese covered it up. They did this, that, the other thing. It is true that the Wuhan authorities covered it up for the first few weeks because they were going to have a big party congress. It was a big mistake. They got fired. Then when the central government heard about it, they shut the whole place down. If you compare the U.S. and the Chinese current epidemic, there's just no comparison. On a daily basis, 1,000 people plus in the United States get infected, are reported to be infected, and in China, it's no more than 30. When you look at the number of deaths, it's over 1,000 a day in the U.S. It's 0 to 3 in China. That's an enormous difference. With the tools we have, not the ones we're anxiously waiting for, you can squish this epidemic down to close to zero.
Yeah.
And I'm actually writing a piece right now where we analyze how they did that. I'll give you an example of how they did that. I have a good friend in a senior position, an American, who traveled from Frankfurt to Shanghai. There was one person on the plane who had symptoms. Everybody in the plane got on their cell phone a note: show up downstairs tomorrow morning, you're going to be going into mandatory quarantine for up to 14 days from the time you stepped off the airplane. A car picked them up, hazmat clad, took them to a hotel where they were in separate rooms for the 14 days. They didn't see another human being who wasn't hazmat clad. And the only one they did see came to clean their room once a day. In that story, there is no test. There's wonderful contact tracing and mandatory controlled isolation. They had to disinfect their feces and their urine, something we don't even think about. But we know the virus can be transmitted by sewer gas. So that's the detail that they have. That's how you do it. It's so far from what we do. Mm-hmm. So even if we had the right leadership saying, you've got to protect yourselves, we just aren't simply prepared to execute at that level. The Europeans did a pretty good job. They had a big epidemic. They didn't take it seriously at first. Then they realized they had to. They forced people to stay at home. They forced people to wear masks. If you went out in France and it wasn't your hour to be at the grocery store, right, you had a $1,000 fine or yeah, more. Yeah. And the second time, you might go to jail.
Yeah.
We could do that, but we didn't do it. And so what did they do? They pushed the epidemic down to the, not down to zero a day, a couple of hundreds a day. And they're getting the infection back because you got to really push it down
yeah,
all the way. Mm-hmm. They're going to have a big problem this fall, and it's already showing up. You have to remember, one person started this whole epidemic.
Right.
If you have 100 people a day, each one of those can start the epidemic. And that's just the people you're catching. It's not the people who are really contagious even. And I'll give you one final number. More people have died in the United States than got infected in China. And when I say that, most people say, well, you can't believe the Chinese numbers.
Yeah.
Well, I can see Chinese reality.
Yeah.
I see my friend, my people who work for me, going to movie theaters, going to restaurants, showing up at our offices to work. So that's, I think, a long answer to your question, but it covers a good chunk of ground.
Dr. Hazeltine is also the author of two new books, A Family Guide to COVID, Questions and Answers for Parents, Grandparents, and Children, and A COVID Back to School Guide, both of which are continually updating living e-books, offering answers to the many questions families have about navigating their way through the pandemic. Conversations on Healthcare is produced by the Community Health Center of Connecticut and hosted by Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter. Sue Balcom is next.
Next time on The Pulse, mosquitoes are a bit like supervillains.
They actually mate in flight.
They can breed pretty much anywhere.
A bottle cap that fills with rainwater.
They can survive winter.
They produce a lot of sugar in their cells that works like antifreeze.
So in fighting them, the odds are stacked against us.
They're very successful creatures.
A look at our contentious relationship with mosquitoes.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is root seller Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation. I just love visiting with you.
And the end of August, early September, this time of year, sometimes you can go out into the garden and feel a little overwhelmed.
Or a lot overwhelmed if you're as dumb as I was, thinking I can handle a garden
twice the size. I can do 200 tomatoes.
Oh my God, you guys. And in the beginning of the year, it was like there was bare ground in between the squash
right?
plants. And there's these sticks that look like tomato plants dying on the vine, and this south wind is blowing in it, and it's like, oh my gosh, we're not going to get anything out of the garden. It's just going to be a disaster.
it's always a real trial of patience.
Oh, I know, right? And why don't I put a few more plants in, cover that dirt up? Holy cow, it's like a Stephen King movie out there. Like when you wade through the squash and the pumpkin, searching for the cabbages that I know are down there somewhere, there's vines that are wrapping themselves around my ankles and they're climbing up trying to get to the sun. I'm like, let me out of here.
Is this like the little barbershop of horrors, like in your house?
Yes. Yes. I'm not kidding you.
If ever you disappear, check the high tunnel. Okay, JC.
I'm looking in there and I'm flabbergasted at how beautiful everything has come along. And we have been pickling and selling at the market and making salsa and doing all these things. And so I don't know if this is a very pleasant word to use, but when you have a glut of produce like we have right now, you have to look for some alternative things to do. You eat as much as you can fresh, of course, but then you want to kind of preserve some for the winter time. Mm-hmm. And I've been experimenting with some crazy recipes when I have excess produce. So I have two recipe books I would highly recommend for anybody who wants to do more gardening. Although I would like make a plan for next year, like only 98 tomato plants instead of 150, maybe something like that. But one of these books I mentioned before when we were talking about pies is called The Harvest Baker with Ken Heidrich, who is the dean of the Pie Academy. And that's a self-imposed title, I'm sure.
Title, though.
Oh, I do too. I think it's so awesome. And what
really
he had,
it
this
comes with a sash.
This and a little cap with a tassel.
No.
So anyway, this book is just like so amazing because his recipes aren't just pies. You know, it starts out with fruit muffins, butternut squash muffins, corn off the cob sour cream cornbread. Now, doesn't that sound amazing?
That sounds great.
You know, like if you buy a dozen cobs and you eat six of them, you're like, what can I do that would be different? And his recipes are so simple. I found this great one for tomato jam.
What is tomato jam?
I had never heard of this before, but when I was at my Uncle Ed's house one time, he went into the refrigerator and he brought out this jar of black looking stuff. And I'm like, what is that? And his mother, my grandmother, used to cook tomatoes down until they were so super condensed, they were black. And then they spread that on toast and crackers. And I personally didn't care for that. So this recipe isn't cooked down quite that much, this tomato jam recipe in the Harvest Baker. But then you can use it on pizzas. You could spread it on toast.
How would it be different from a tomato paste?
Well, I'm wondering if that isn't kind of the avenue they're headed for there, is a condensed tomato. But this has sugar in it and some spices, you know, and some lemon juice and vinegar and my favorite freshly grated ginger, which I love. So it is a little bit more sophisticated palate taste, you know. So while they did that, I'm sure, so they didn't have to throw anything away, they did the same thing with watermelon. And I just learned this after I threw the center of a watermelon away when I was pickling watermelon, was they didn't have access to sugar sometimes back in the day. They did was they cooked watermelon down and made it kind of like a gel sweetener that they could use in breads and things like that. And I thought, they never wasted anything back then.
Right?
But think of how much fun it would be to kind of bring some of these things back again to, you know, liven up your menu, especially if you have excess produce. Like you start out canning tomatoes, then you make some salsa, then you make some spaghetti sauce, and then you start with the ketchup. And maybe some spicy tomato juice.
You could have like a 12-course meal of tomatoes, it sounds like.
Oh, and then, of course, in the meantime, when you're out picking them, I have these cherry tomatoes, I swear, are 2 inches across.
Jeez.
They're fabulous. They're Fox cherry tomatoes, and they come from Prairie Road Organic Seed Company in Fullerton. And, you know, with those, you can actually cut them in half, lay them cut side up, drizzle them with olive oil, reduce them down.
Oven dried tomatoes.
Oh my gosh, they're divine. And then if you don't want to eat all of them just like that day, then you can put those in a freezer bag. We use a Steel-O-Meal for all that kind of stuff to keep it keeps longer than putting it in a plain Ziploc.
Mm-hmm.
And you can save it, take it out, put them on pizza. You can put them in soup. I mean, the flavor is so intense because they've been dehydrated, sort of. Put a little salt and pepper on there. Fabulous, fabulous.
Mm. You sent a little sheet ahead of time for ways to use up garden produce, and I'm seeing the word vodka on here.
Woo! Yeah, you want to skip right back to the vodka. Sure. Okay.
Are we talking an excess of potatoes is here?
Actually, you got to go buy your vodka.
Okay.
This is kind of cool because, you know, you can grow one chili pepper plant and you'll have an abundance of chili peppers. So this book is called The Batch, or just Batch. And this is a fabulous book because it uses every single part of the plant in multiple ways, multiple processes, from cellaring to fermenting to canning to pressure canning to drying, all those kinds of things. But what they did was they made chili-infused vodka.
Ooh.
And he said he likes to make it like super strong, so he just crushed a bunch of those peppers into a mason jar, like as many as he could, filled it up with vodka, and then you let it steep.
That's a good idea.
Well, right, but this is really hot, so you're going to have to like maybe dilute it with more vodka or something, or use it for cooking.
Oh yeah,
but
there
are
a lot of good vodka red sauces out there. Speaking of pizza,
nice. Yeah. You can make a chili salt then too if you're not into the vodka thing. But you know, use vodka for making vanilla. And I do that around the house too. Make vanilla with vanilla beans and vodka. So vodka is a handy thing to have, and you should always keep it in your freezer. I've actually heard it makes pie crust better if you put in a couple tablespoons of vodka instead of water when you're making pie crust, cold vodka. So
are they putting it in the pie crust or in the pie baker?
I don't know.
One for you, one for me.
Really good. Yeah. No. But you know, chili salt or any kind of dried herb salts, you know, you can use a coarse salt and you blend your herbs or blend your dried chili peppers.
Oh, yeah.
And you can use ghost peppers if you're brave, and you can make your own flavored salts. I made lime and chili salt one of those little graters and grate that, peel off the lime and use that with your salt.
You know, and if you're one of those people who does Christmas before December 23rd, thinking about Christmas, you could start making some of your handmade gifts right now with this fresh produce.
That's a fabulous idea. Yes, you could do a whole pepper set with a chili vodka and a jalapeno jam and a chili salt. Yeah, that would be perfect. You can use your blender, your little Oscar, or your Ninja to, you know, grind this stuff up quite easily. And it goes fast. You get little clean canning jars if you can find them. There seems to be a shortage of that stuff this year, but you know, there's stuff out there. But in addition to like these funky recipes in here, the Batch book, which has really become one of my go-to books when I have lots of stuff, you know, they go through salting and smoking vegetables and how to put things into your root cellar, dehydrating, fermenting. I found a fermented salsa recipe. I cannot wait to try it. Oh my gosh.
Oh,
I can't wait.
That sounds fabulous.
Well, right. And, you know, contrary to popular belief, you're not going to poison yourself if you leave something set on your counter, like tomatoes and onions and that. Yeah.
Kind of the occasional explosion, but. you know.
Oh, that's right. You know all too well about fermented explosions.
I do. Sadly.
So this recipe recommends pouring a little bit of an olive oil seal over the top and then letting it ferment for a couple of days. And then you stir that oil in there and it becomes part of the recipe. So, but I love fermented foods. Like I love when my pickles want to blow up out of the jar. It's sauerkraut. Like it's sauerkraut season coming up here. So as soon as I get my cabbage out of the garden, that's my next big project.
Well, my taste buds love the fermented food, but also so does my belly. Like it really, I feel so much better when I'm eating a lot of fermented or even pickled foods. Like I don't bloat as much. I have better energy.
And what you want to do always is eat something fermented with almost every one of your meals will help you digest just about any bad food that you're going to eat. You know, like if you can't tolerate eating bread products and you're not celiac, you could certainly give that a try. Sourdough bread is fermented, but you could eat it with fermented vegetables. I think my ancestors ate a lot of pickles to offset smoked meats that they ate. You know, that was one of their preservation methods, was smoking meats and making smoked sausages. And so that kind of balances out the bad, you know? So if you're kind of eating those fermented foods, like you said, that really helps with your gut bacteria and your digestion. And then, like me, you can eat whatever you want.
Yep, works for me.
Works for me.
Spicy vegetables and ice cream is pretty much all I eat.
Well, right. And I'm wondering, did you ever have any like chili pepper ice cream that you can recall ever finding?
I've had spicy, like a really spicy mango. So it was probably a pepper. It was probably mango pepper, something like that.
Because I love cinnamon ice cream. I make really good cinnamon ice cream. I'm wondering if I should throw a little
peppery chocolote too.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I love chili pepper peppers in my chocolate. Mm-hmm. Ooh. And if you don't like heat, of course, there's beet hummus. I found a recipe for that in one of these books. And I thought, wouldn't that be cool? Beets are such a beautiful color.
Yeah.
They have lots of good things in there for you. And, you know, if you don't like garbanzo beans, which just happen to be one of my favorite things in the world, you can try a beet hummus if you have lots of extra beets in your garden. And that would make for a pretty Christmas dish, too, because you use canned beets. So we should probably stop talking about Christmas. Now my mind is going a whole different direction.
Another segment.
Another segment, right. Too many vegetables, too little time.
Well, we will check out these books. Again, it's called Batch, and the other one is called The Harvest Baker. Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food, and you can find out more on her website, therootsellers.com, and that's seller with an S, like she's selling you something. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It's been my pleasure.
Support for this program is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine, showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com.
Although Theodore Roosevelt was one of the strongest and most charismatic of American presidents, he could not have accomplished all that he did without his circle of friends and advisors. Explore TR's Inner Circle during the 15th Annual Theodore Roosevelt Symposium, September 17th through the 19th. This virtual event features three keynote speakers and a tour of the rugged Badlands. This event is sponsored by Dickinson State University and Prairie Public. Register online at dickinsonstate.edu/TR.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 3rd. On this date in 1904, the Grand Army of the Republic concluded its annual meeting in Boston. The Washburn leader announced that the organization elected officers and chose Denver as the location of the next annual encampment. The Grand Army of the Republic, known as the GAR, was an organization for Union veterans of the Civil War. It was established in Springfield, Illinois in 1866. Eventually, there were hundreds of posts across the country. Many Dakotans fought for the Union, and other Union veterans immigrated to the territory after the war. Posts in the state were named for notable Civil War figures. Post number 1 in Fort Yates, named for George Custer, was organized in 1882. Other posts were named for Generals Reynolds, Burnside, and Grant. The Castleton Post was named for abolitionist John Brown, who had led a raid before the war on the federal arsenal at Harper's Ferry. The Larimore Post was Appomattox, site of Lee's surrender to Grant. The Mayville Post, formed in 1889, was the last North Dakota post to be organized. It was named for Brigadier General Farnsworth, who was killed at Gettysburg. The GAR engaged in political activities, lobbying for veterans' pensions, voting rights for black veterans, benefits for widows and orphans, and recognizing Memorial Day as a national holiday. At least as important were the social activities that allowed veterans to maintain a bond of camaraderie. Interestingly, the GAR also sought reconciliation with Confederate veterans. The organization formally invited their Southern counterparts to a gathering at the 25th anniversary of Gettysburg. The Union veterans hoped the occasion would be a moment to, quote, record in friendship and fraternity the sentiments of goodwill, loyalty, and patriotism, which now unite all in sincere devotion to the country, unquote. Veterans of the blue and the gray famously shook hands across the stone wall that marked the high water mark of the Confederacy and pledged their loyalty to one Constitution and one flag. The high point of the GAR came in 1890 during commemorations of the 25th anniversary of the war's end. At that time, membership numbered 410,000. After that date, membership dwindled as Civil War veterans passed away. Albert Wolson was the last member. He died in Duluth in 1956. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Carol Butcher. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Food and clothes you buy at a store likely got there on a truck. The cost to haul those goods is cheaper these days, but someone is paying a price, the drivers.
It got to the point where I would be sitting in my truck crying because I'd be afraid to buy a hot dog. There has to be something better.
Why some truckers are driving more and getting paid less. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, take advantage of the nice weather and the ability to be outdoors and see people with a fun social distance event. It is the 18th annual Hot Air Balloon Rally in Medora. It's coming up next weekend, and we'll learn about it tomorrow on the show. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.